Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Peter Maxwell Slattery Show. And today, our guest is Ben Hurl. How you going, Ben?
I'm good, Peter. How are you?
Good, mate. Now, you run Victoria UFO Action in Victoria there. Whereabouts are you located at the moment?
I'm located in Bairnsdale, which is in East Gippsland, up in the 20 end of the state. And I run the group from here. With a couple of guys who are based in Melbourne, and it's a great place to live because we have our own UFO history in this area.
Fantastic, fantastic. So how did you get into the topic of UFOs?
Well, I've been into it ever since I was a kid. You know, one of the first books I bought was a book on UFOs from the school library. And it covered off on all the famous cases of Betty Hill and Travis Walton and lots of other cases. And since that time, it's always been a lifelong interest. I had a couple of my own experiences a few years ago too, which sort of really woke me to the fact that we certainly are not alone in this world. And when I was about 40 or so, I decided, well, now's the time to get into it. I want to get into investigation. Investigation is something that had certainly dropped off in Victoria with the closure of UForce. So the time was right for me to get into it. So I went down to Melbourne and I went to a UFORN meeting, which George Simpson runs down here. And at that meeting, I met Andrew Arnold, who founded UFOLA. And we basically became best friends pretty much straight away. And I started off by doing some cartoons for him because I also do some alien cartoons. And I then progressed on to being the Eastern Region investigator. And after that, Andrew got a bit tired. He burned himself out. And I took over the directorship probably over a year ago now.
So now you're at the top of it.
Yeah, that's right. I've come a long way fairly quickly.
Yep. Would you mind telling us about the sightings you had?
Well, I've had a couple of UFO sightings. I lived out of town here, about 20 minutes out of town to the north, and just in a little tiny rural hamlet area. And one night, I got up in the night to let my little Jack Russell out to go to the toilet, and he went running down the hill, and I stepped outside as well. And I looked off to the north, and I could see these two bright objects side by side coming towards our direction. And they basically shot straight overhead side by side. They were larger than football fields, and they went from north to south as quickly as you could turn your head from north to south, completely silent. And I was just gobsmacked at what I'd seen. It certainly wasn't they certainly weren't aircraft, because that's not really a flight path direction for where I live. Most of the air traffic around here goes east, west, and west, east. And traveling north to south like that, they were solid, bright, in tandem together. I just had no idea what it was.
Amazing, yep.
Mm. And out there at the same time on another night too, I remember being out of my patio and I looked up in the sky and just probably not that far away, I'd say probably less than 5 km away and probably only about a kilometre up in the air, was a bright light was hovering in the air. And it then started moving in really strange directions. It was sort of darting around back and forth, up and down, right angle, stopping, moving. And I watched that across the sky, across the mountains too, on one particular evening. And I'm fairly well versed with the sky because I've sort of studied astronomy as a hobby, and I've seen everything from satellites to comets to space junk burning up on re-entry. I've seen a lot of things that are up there, but they were the two main experiences that I'd had, that I went through the checklist in my head about what they logically could have been, and I couldn't come up with any answers.
Yeah, no, it happens. It happens, yeah. So with your UFO group, you usually got a hotline, haven't you?
We do, yes. We decided probably about a year ago, we went on a bit of a drive to try and recruit some more members. So on the website we have a fairly large membership, but I put out a call and had a heap of people come along to a meeting that I actually held at Westall. And at that meeting we recruited probably about another up to 10 people who came on board as team members. And we decided that we needed to get a hotline up and running. Because it really was the only way that that Victorians could actually report sightings.
Yeah, well, it's good that you've done that, because you know, some people need somewhere to report what's going on, and you suppose people can also report their experiences to your group as well, can't they?
They can. You can report by two ways. You can ring the hotline, which is the first way, and we do get a lot of reports coming in from that avenue. But we also have an email address as well that people can report onto, sightings@viewfoa.com. And for people who don't want to necessarily talk face-to-face about it, and some people can be a bit sort of reticent to talk about their experiences, reporting via email is another option that they can pursue.
Yep, now that's good. Now, in the reporting area, I noticed that is in one of the boxes there, you've got an area if you're a pilot or a police officer. Have you had anybody with those sort of social status come forward and report anything to you guys?
Yes, I have had people come forward from those type of industries and report sightings to us. They tend to be the most secretive of all, and certainly don't like to have their details released. But yeah, we do from time to time get those sort of people coming forward, and it's good to see it when they do come forward.
Yeah, yeah. And also that you've got support for abductees or experiences, haven't you?
We have, yes. Yeah, yep. We basically try to run the group from a threefold point of view. One being investigation, which is, you know, you can report anything from lights in the sky through to a landing site on the ground, and we've got a team of people that can go out and do on-site investigations. We have Brenda Butler available to us, and Brenda is a hypnotherapist in Melbourne who has impeccable skills with handling people who've had abduction scenarios. And she basically works with our group, and when we get people who've had those experiences, we do a pre-qualify sort of a check on them first, and if we're happy that they're suitable for referral, we then refer them on to Brenda. And the third aspect of UFOA is we are a reporting organisation as well, and we run UFOA TV, which is our channel where we put all our interviews up. We do a lot of interviews with interesting people in the UFO field, and that's really the three main aspects of what we do: investigation, abduction support, and reporting of events.
No, that's good. That's good, especially with the experience part, because I know what it's like myself, where for a while you have no one to go to, and then you know eventually you come across something. So it's good that you encompass that in what you guys do now. You guys are doing some cases as like a cold case perspective, sort of looking at old cases and sort of, you know, really looking at the whole situation and the evidence and what's been reported. Can you update us on anything that you guys have done?
Yes, certainly can, Peter. We've once I saw the Westall 66 documentary came out, A Suburban Mystery by Shane Ryan and Rosie Jones, and it's an absolutely fantastic piece on a very important part of Australian UFO history.
I've seen that myself. Are you able to just go over quickly the Westall incident, just for the listeners out there that may have not heard of it?
Yeah. On the 6th of April 1966, at about 11:30 in the morning, students at Westall High School were going about their studies, and some of them were doing phys ed on the oval and plus other classes. And they noticed out of the northerly direction a series of objects came towards the school, and they basically came and touched down quite close to the boundary, and the kids ran over from the school, and basically the school almost went into chaos because a lot of kids came running out and they all wanted to go over and see what had come out of the sky. And one of the boys even jumped the fence and actually touched one of the objects, which I think would have been a fascinating experience.
And
then the objects took off and they headed over towards the Grange, which is a really odd little park in Melbourne. You wouldn't even know it was there. And again, the objects, they touched down over there again, and the kids ran over to the Grange and they ran through all the market gardens that were there at the time. And now it's just housing. If you go there now, it's just basically a housing tract there. And they ran across, and the objects were there again. The objects basically disappeared at that point, and there were some planes flying in the air as well, which were up in the air. And the military seemed to get on to the site fairly quickly as well. And it was pretty much hushed up at the time. The incident.
Yeah, they were pretty much told to shut up, weren't they?
They were. The kids were told by the principal and by the police and other people in uniforms that what they had seen had been a basically a military project, and that they were not to talk about it. And the kids were told basically to shut up, and they for the most part they did. There was one article that appeared in the Dan Yinong Journal at the time with one of the girls in that. Channel 9 ran a news article on the incident, and apart from that, it basically did drop out of the consciousness of Australia for a very, very long time.
There was about 200 witnesses too, weren't there? Like the children and teachers.
There was. It's probably Australia's case that had the most witnesses at the one time, occurring in broad daylight with multiple objects. Over a schoolyard with teachers as witnesses and plus other people, local people in the community as well. It's really a unique event.
Yeah, and that goes back, 1966. So that leads into a case you're looking into at the moment, doesn't it?
That's right, exactly. And, in that particular piece that they did on Westall, they made reference to the Burke's flat bending headlight case, which actually occurred on the 4th of April 1966, and that case involved a man called Ron Sullivan. And Ron Sullivan was a building contractor, and he was driving from his home in Maryborough up to Witchyproof on that evening, to where he was going up to supervise a job the next day. And when he reached close to the halfway point, he reached an area called Burke's Flat in his car, and he was driving along, and he looked off to the right. And he noticed a light in the paddock, and at first he took it to be a tractor light. And as he approached the light, the light split into two, and it became cone-shaped. The top was the larger part, and it rose up, and passing between the top and the bottom were all the colours of the spectrum, and it was very beautiful. And as his car drove towards it, his headlights actually bent in towards the object. And he nearly followed his headlights off the road, but he countersteered in the opposite direction, narrowly missing a tree on the opposite side of the road. And basically, he slowed right down, and the object basically then closed itself back up again and disappeared. And Ron was basically fairly terrified, and he drove off to St Arnett, and he stopped at St Arnett, and he was very puzzled about the event. And it gets a little more interesting than that, because 3 days later, a couple of young men were driving from Melbourne up to Donald, and they came through the same area in two separate cars, and one man was actually killed at the same spot where Ron saw the object. In fact, he hit the tree that Ron narrowly avoided. So it becomes a very interesting case, because here we've got a highly credible witness who is a pillar of the community, and 2 days later, a young man who was 19 at the time tragically is killed when he runs into the tree. And the only reason that the UFO story came out was because Ron heard about the accident that occurred at Burke's Flat, and he went to the police and he told them about his strange encounter, 3 nights prior to Gary Taylor's crash. So he met up with the local newspaper, and they went out to the site, and out in the paddock they actually found an impression in the ground. And so there was actually a trace sort of evidence that there actually had been something on the ground, and there are photos of that particular landing impression that the newspapers had taken and that type of thing. And so Ron was also interviewed by the Air Force. The Air Force came out and they interviewed him in his house, and they sort of checked his car over, and they said, "Yes, Mr. Sullivan, we'll get back to you, Mr. Sullivan, with what we find, and thank you very much." And off they went, and Ron never heard from them ever again. And it sort of disappeared off the map then for a number of years. And then in 1980, Bill Chalker, who is also a great admirer of the case like myself, Bill decided that he would do a full retrospective investigation. And Bill returned to the site in 1980 and did perhaps the only investigation that had been done on the case up to that time, and he did a great job of it and was very, very thorough. And online there's an article available that you can read that he's actually done on his website. So that was really good. And then after Bill had done his piece, It had been left alone, and it only had just been reference had made to it, touched on lightly in the Westall 66 documentary, and they interviewed Ron. And at that point, I decided, right, this case is much too important to disappear in its own right. It's very credible. There was trace evidence. The UFO itself was very unique. It wasn't your classic silver disc that gets reported a lot of the time. It was quite different to that.
Know the size of, like, has he said to you basically the size of the object? Like, was it basketball size? Was it, you know, the size of a car? Was it bigger than that? Did he go into that with you?
Yeah. Once I made contact with Ron, we went to his home and we did an hour and a half interview with him about the incident. And when we get the documentary released, which we'll hopefully have out before Christmas, he did a blackboard presentation for us of how the object actually was. And it was roughly about a meter and a half at the bottom, and it rose up to about 4 meters at the top. So it was quite large when you look at it. And it was a very conical shape, very much like an ice cream cone. The light itself was, he described it as a white phosphorus light. It cast no shadows at all. So the light was fully contained. And I think I've seen that in other UFO reports too, where the lights, they don't actually reflect. There's no shadows.
Yeah, I've seen that myself. Especially I've noticed that with orbs. Even in the house here, when I see them on occasion, there's sort of no shadow, and it's like they're light, but they're not a light. Like some of them don't even give off light. They can give off reflection, but the aspect of what they are compared to, you know, something maybe naturally, or, you know, a normal light source is very different.
That's correct. And this particular, you know, I mean, one of the most interesting things about the entire case and what makes it world famous is the fact that his headlights were attracted to the object. So that's a very mysterious phenomenon as to what it was about the nature of the object that made the headlights actually bend off the road and were attracted to the object. And Ron also reported to me that he felt like his insides were being drawn out as he passed it. So whether there was some type of gravity effect in the area that may have been selective in how it reacted, because it wasn't like a black hole. It didn't create like a massive effect where it pulled trees out of the ground or, you know, things were drawn towards the object. It only had very subtle effects like bending the lights and making Ron feel like he was being pulled out of his body as he drove past it. So it was a very localized effect on the area.
Very weird. Now, has he reported anything like high strangeness before or since the incident?
No, not at all. Ron's a very down-to-earth type of a guy. He's never had any other experiences, to my knowledge, and this has been his only experience that he's had. But basically, it's haunted him all these years. It's something that he can't forget. It was an amazing experience, and part of what I wanted to do was to recapture it again for him. And next weekend, we're going to take him back to Burke's flat. For the first time in years for him. So we're going to take him back to the very location. I found the exact spot. So we know we're going to the exact spot. I did a lot of work to relocate the exact area, and we've found it 100%. We've got it. And we want to take him back there. And we want to, you know, film his reactions at being back at Burke's flat again. And we're going to go over the events again, step by step, with him actually on site. And we're also going to erect a plaque at the location, so that other people will know that this is where one of Australia's best UFO events actually occurred. And one of my team members, Ivan, works for a trophy business, and we were able to get a beautiful golden plaque made up. And I spoke to the landowners a couple of weeks ago, and they've given us permission to actually erect it at the site.
Oh, that's cool, and it's good what they've done with Westall as well, how they've put that playground in. It's sort of like what they've done at Texas Aurora, where apparently that alien was in the cemetery there, and I think they put a sign or plaque up there, something as well. And they've got the similar stuff at Roswell, so it's good that we've put something there. It sort of makes people think about it.
It does, and I think that what we run the risk of in Australian ufology is that, you know, like a lot of the, you know, like I said, like, you know, Vuforce sort of disappeared in Victoria, and it's very important that some of these events don't get lost. And, you know, there's a plaque down at Cape Otway for Fred Valentich, and in the same way that we basically thought that Ron's case has enough significance to it that it really did warrant some type of acknowledgement that it actually occurred. And to put a sign in the location where it occurred means that anyone else who's a real sleuth like I am and wants to try and find the spot can actually do it a bit easier because we've actually done the groundwork for them. We've found the exact spot and we're going to be marking it.
Now, Ron's getting on a bit in age, but I know myself from, you know, what I've seen and witnessed and the experiences, age wouldn't really come into it with this fool remembering because it would be sticking with him like glue, wouldn't it? Like his memory of that incident would be pretty clear, wouldn't it?
His memory is crystallized clear of it. Ron's 86 years old now, and when we interviewed him at his home, I hardly had to say a word. He just spoke so beautifully about the incident, and he had it all in his head. It came out totally logically and step by step, and you can see in his eyes that the man is actually, you know, he has been affected by this event. You know, it's been 47 years since it occurred, and for him, it's as live in his mind's eye now as it was on the day that it actually happened.
Yeah. Now, Chalker looked over the case earlier on. That was the 80s, you were saying, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1980. Bill went back there and did a very thorough examination of the location.
Yep. So, you looking back into the case, have you found? You would have obviously looked into what Bill had got from the case. Have you found anything else yourself on top of the case that's that may have not stood out or some correlation things just within the case that just, you know, might not be picked up first time round, or, you know, what have you found with the case since Bill? I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're asking me. Look, realistically, I think some of the things that we've found that I haven't read anywhere else was the fact that Ron said that he felt like his insides were being pulled out, and I haven't read that anywhere online in any other forum anywhere at all.
Yep.
So I thought that was very interesting that he had the physical effect on himself at the time. He also reported to us, and I haven't read this anywhere else, that there were dead birds at the location. When they went back there 2 days later, he described them as galahs, you know, basically the old Australian galah. There was several dead galahs in the paddock, enough for it to be noted that there were dead galahs in the paddock. So whether the object at the time had some type of an effect on the birds, and they were only freshly dead too. He said they hadn't been there as in like, you know, like they weren't like hadn't been there for weeks or anything. They looked like they'd only been there for a couple of days. So that was also quite interesting as well. And as a part of Gary Taylor's situation, we were able to get the coroner's report into Gary's death and the police accident report. And we're going through that at the moment, and we've dissected his last hours rather well, and there might be some more things to come out of that yet too, but I can't talk about them yet.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, one question I've got that just came to mind is, has there been any reports going back to around that time up to today of sightings in that area?
Yes, there has, actually. Burke's Flat is a rather unique place in Australia. There's been several other reports of strange lights, and in fact one of the things I'm doing when we're going up there, I've spoken to the farming families and I've got permission to go onto the property where Ron had the encounter, and the owner told me of the property that there had been several other UFO events that she was aware of in her lifetime, and the farm had actually been in the family since 1835, so the farming families don't change up there very readily. And there's at least another one or two cases that I'm aware of UFO and even potential ghost activity in the Burke's Flat area. To describe it as haunted is something that I would probably do. I think that it is an area that has a strangeness to it. I'm in the process of trying to discover what that might be. What is the attraction to this area for UFOs and maybe other phenomena?
Have you looked into any Aboriginal law going back into that area?
I haven't had a chance to do that yet, but that's one thing that I'm definitely going to do, Peter. I've been working hard just to get the documentary up and running.
Yeah, now there's a lot to cover. Like it's just like the it's not to that extent, but I was just what comes to mind was the Skinwalker Ranch in America, where you've got a lot of Native American folklore, and you know you've got the Sherman Ranch or the Skinwalker Ranch, and there's just you've sort of got every type of paranormal activity you can think of going on in the spot. So there might be, not to that extent, but there might be something similar, going on in that area.
Yeah, look, it's interesting, because, I spoke to another farmer up there and he said to me, look, I've been here since, I've been farming this land for over 40-odd years, and he said, I've never seen anything. So it's interesting that, that these events do occur in a certain area, but they certainly, by all means, may not occur every day, or, they're not an everyday event. So, but there are other reports, and when I get over there next weekend, I'm going to go to some great lengths to extract some more stories from that area.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good.
I can tell you briefly about one. She reported to me that some people were out doing making hay, and this object came out of the sky and basically came down and hovered right above them where they were actually making the hay, and the lights were beaming down from the ship, and they were basically lit up the whole area where the tractors and the trailers were doing the hay, and then it flew off. So
was that during the day?
No, it was at night time. During night time, hay gathering.
Yeah, pretty darn hot job that is.
It is, yeah, up in that area, and you're on the edge of the Wimmera, so it's getting up towards the start of Victoria's desert country up there. So it's a hot area.
Yeah. Now, similar to here, like after I was on Sunrise and had a bit of media exposure back when, all that was going on, I was surprised with. I've had a lot of, I can't even count the amount of sightings I've had now or interactions, but it's funny that a lot of our farmers from the Albury area, even going down to sort of Falls Creek and Bright, I've heard a lot of stories like Mount Buffalo area coming back this way, even past where I live going north. There's a lot of farmers with, some stories, and it's sort of a hot spot around this area as well, so it's pretty fascinating, especially this area. I hear a lot of stuff from truck drivers that will be driving at night, and they'll see these lights. And, you've sort of just got these spots sort of just spotted all over Australia where there's, pretty much high strangeness or, UFOs rocking up here and there. So,
One of Victoria's hottest spots, I believe, personally, in the involvement that I've had with UFO investigation over the last 3 years or so, is Narre Warren in Melbourne.
That's been getting heaps of stuff.
Yeah, it's a very, very active area for UFO activity, Narre Warren. Narre Warren in the Dandenong Range area, Warburton. Back in March this year, we were in the Herald Sun. We had a double-page feature article on UFO that was published. The Herald Sun approached me and they wanted to run an article. And so we gave them about four or five current cases at the time that we had, and they did a really good piece on it. And I had I had 50 calls from over Victoria after that point, and one of them was from the Warburton Rangers, and so many from Narre Warren. So it's just a very busy, active part of Victoria. But having said that, every area of Victoria has a rich UFO history. So while you have got the hotspot areas like Narre Warren and different areas, every area has got a UFO history.
Yeah. Have you or your group looked into the Frederick Valentich case again? I think there was some new data board out a while ago. I'm not sure if it was the police documents that were, or some type of government documents were released under the Freedom of Information Act, I think. Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, we've done some work on the Fred Valentich case. We've made some mini documentaries on it, and covering the basic events of what actually occurred. And there has been some more breakthroughs. I'm not the expert on that, but essentially there has been some new leads come up. And the latest Ufologist magazine that's out at the moment has got an article by George Simpson in it. And in that article, George really goes over a new lead that's come to light in the Valentich case, and it's quite fascinating. So I'd encourage anyone out there to go buy the current Ufologist, and there's a really good summary of it.
Yeah, no, that's good. Do you know if there were I think it was documents released in the past year or so. I'm not sure.
I think there's been Department of Transport documents have been released in recent times. Keith Basterfield's done a lot of good work in, going through the government files and bringing out different files and that have been done. There's a documentary made recently called The Unexplained Files, made by Discovery Channel in England, And that recovered the case very, very well. And for the first time, we actually get to hear the noise, the strange noise that was recorded on the tape.
That was the control tower tape.
Yeah. That he'd been talking to Steve Roby at the time, and that they released the last 17 seconds of the actual tape, which is a strange metallic sound. And that documentary actually isn't available in Australia. I have seen it. And, you know, a few people in the UFO world have actually seen it and we've heard the sound. It's a very unusual sound, but I'm still sort of reluctant to draw any conclusions myself as to what the sound is.
I'm wondering I'd like to hear it because actually my recent documentary I put out, what led me to get my first hypnosis session done, all my books up to that point were from recollection. But I spoke to Mary Rodwell after an incident with a friend where I had missing time. It was just out of Beechworth in Victoria going towards Mount Buffalo, and we didn't feel right, but we heard this weird, I described it as a angel playing a didgeridoo. It was a weird sound, very weird. I don't know why I describe it that way, but it's the only way I can describe it. It sounds stupid, but that's the way I've got to describe it. But I spoke to Rodwell over Skype, and I was telling her about it, and she started playing this sound, this MP3 she had, and it was the exact sound. And I said, where did you get that? Now, mind you, after I heard this sound, I continued to drive, and for some reason I had to turn right going into Myrtleford, and I had to go to Lake Buffalo. And when we got out of the car, I saw a craft blink in and out above me. I wasn't going to say anything with the lady that I was with, but she was like, did you see that? And I said, yeah, I saw that. Well, when Mary played this, that was the exact sound we heard before before we had the sighting in the car, and it was a sound of a UFO that James Gilliland recorded at his ranch, I think. It was recorded by James Gilliland, but I don't know if it was at the ranch. I surmise it was, because a lot of activity happens there. But I'd be very interested in hearing that sound to see if it's very similar. It's different recordings I've heard.
Yeah, I'd describe the sound as being almost like a metallic scratching sound.
Was there any sort of hum to it?
Not really. No, it's kind of sounds like it's a scratch. It's been described a number of ways. It's been described as a ball bearing rattling around in the bottom of a bucket.
Yep.
A metal bucket. That's probably one of the most common descriptions I've heard of it. I describe it more as a scratching type of a metallic scratching sound. When I actually heard it, so. It's always open to the interpretation by the listener, I suppose. It is an unusual sound. It's not something that you would hear. And one of the theories is that it's actually the plane got attached to the side of the UFO, and basically that it was the sound of the propeller basically banging against the side of the UFO. I don't know. It's very hard to say. Like, we don't have any more evidence, and I tend to come to the whole phenomenon as on a very much an evidence basis. So the sound is sort of getting out there now, and it's definitely worth listening to.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye out for it. That's pretty interesting. Now, the plane was never found, was it?
No, the plane disappeared. He was basically he spoke to the traffic controllers for about roughly a 20-minute period, and after that, he disappeared. They pretty much started searching for the plane fairly quickly, and in fact they searched for it for 2 weeks afterwards, and they found no sign of it, no wreckage, no oil slicks, no. They did find an oil slick, but it was actually marine diesel.
Yep.
Not Cessna oil. So they did have quite an extensive search at the time, and he never turned up. No.
Trippy stuff. Now, what activity, like in the past year, say, or anything stand out of your mind besides the activity in Melbourne? Has anything sort of been brought to you guys through the website or in reporting of, sort of major things that stand out for you with what's going on in Victoria, UFO sighting or encounter-wise?
Yeah, I had a great UFO report come to me probably about 2 months ago. There's several things I love about this report. The first was it came from two girls who worked for the DSE, the Department of Sustainability and Environment, and they worked up in the High Country area of Victoria.
Now, is that towards what area that, like, towards Buffalo, or is it towards Mount Buller, or is it towards Bogong?
No, the Omeo area.
Well, that's past Hotham. Yeah, yep. No, I know the area you're talking about. Yep.
Yeah, so Omeo Benambra area up there. So they basically contacted me, and they were quite scared. They'd been out visiting friends, and they were driving home to their property, which wasn't in a town. It was out in the country, and they were driving home, and they came over a hill, and as they came over the hill, you could look down a valley into where the house was. And as they came over the hill, they saw this bright sapphire blue object about the size of a bus hovering directly above their house. And similar to the Ron Sullivan report, it wasn't casting any shadows. It was just a fully contained sapphire-coloured, sort of a bright blue light. And they stopped the car and they got out and they basically sort of clutched onto each other and they watched as this object just sat there silently hovering above the house. And they started shouting at it, to telling it to go away, because they didn't know what it was. So they're yelling at this object, "Go away, go away, that's our house, don't hover over our house." And the object sort of stood hovered in the air, and then it sort of tilted a bit, and it drifted away from the house out over the paddock. And then it tilted and it shot straight up into the sky in the blink of a heartbeat. And the girls were absolutely terrified of this. And the thing that I find so fascinating about this report is that these girls don't have any interest in UFOs at all. They're hunting, fishing, horse riding, motorbike riding type of girls. They UFOs and aliens are not something that comes into their worldview in any way, shape or form. And I really love witnesses like that, because they come to you with such shock at the realization when they actually see something that they just absolutely cannot explain. And it was really credible, because, you know, because of that very basis, the fact that it's not something that they dreamed up. It wasn't something that they thought of. It was something that they were absolutely terrified of. And it was a really good report.
No, that's good. Now, do you know with the sighting, if it was a bright light, but it wasn't that bright where they couldn't look at it, like they could focus their eyes on it?
No, they could definitely see it. She didn't report to me that it was...
blinding, where you look at it and you look away. Yeah,
she didn't report it as being blinding, just that it was a bright solid blue light, roughly the size of a bus. It appeared to be sort of like it had come out of the sky. It hovered above the property, above their house, like it was surveilling the place, if you like. I think that was the impression that they sort of got, and then it sort of slowly moved off, and then it just shot like a bolt, just straight up into the sky, gone, pretty much in an instant. But they got to observe it for several minutes.
No, that's interesting. Very interesting.
Now,
you're the assistant researcher for Nat Geo when they're coming over, or are you already? They're coming over here to do some filming, aren't they?
Ah, yes, the National Geographic channel is in the process of doing a around-the-world series on highly credible UFO cases, and they're really looking for cases that have had some sort of official involvement, either with, like, police witnesses or, where the Air Force or there's been some type of official investigation completed by officialdom. And they're coming to Australia to do an episode on Australia, and they've contacted, I'm not the only person they've contacted quite a few people around the country, and we're kind of helping them to track down witnesses and to track down, what we can find out about some of Australia's, rich histories of UFO cases, and some of them we've been talking about today. They're hoping to come here in December and do some filming around the country. And I think next year we should see a very good balanced view coming out about Australian cases from the National Geographic Channel, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, no, well, hopefully they do a good balanced view. Some of the shows in the past haven't, they say they're going to do something and then they get into it, and it's just like chasing UFOs. And you had James Fox, he said, he was... doing a great job, but once it got to the cutting table, it was sort of not showing everything, and I can understand why he had a bit of a spit about that, which is understandable. So hopefully these guys give us some justice and look into the cases here with an open heart.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the media in general don't understand UFOs. I think that they tend to treat it like a bit of a filler and a bit of a giggle factor. And we always need to be careful if you're involved in the phenomenon in how you deal with the media and be discerning in who you actually deal with when you do deal with them. After our Herald Sun article came out, the Today Show rang me up and they invited me to come onto the show to discuss UFO and discuss UFOs. And we thought about it, but we declined the offer because we thought at this point in time, you know, I was concerned about how they were going to approach the topic. And I didn't want to sit on the couch and have them treat it like it was sort of a bit of a giggle factor because, you know, I believe in it too passionately for it to be treated so flippantly by the media, and particularly general media, you know, like the Today Show and you know, Sunrise and those other type of programs. They don't really have – not coming at it from an understanding point of view.
So, well, they don't look at the hard data. They sort of just assume the way they do. And like I talked on the last episode about what happened with me in Sunrise, and they didn't know what they'd done when they got me on there because I spoke to the producer or one of the people that's in charge of getting me on, and they flew me up there and got on there, and you could tell Mel knew nothing about me or the story. What I noticed too is that in the past, I brought up a lot of government witnesses and what happened in America with the Disclosure Project and, you know, some good cases like Robert Salas and John Callahan and that sort of thing. And they were pretty blown away, but once I went into my experiences and that type of thing, they looked at me like a nut, and that's why I reverted back to that type of thing. But it just showed that they sort of wanted me to go up there, so I was a laughing stock. But once I threw some facts back into their face with the astronauts and, you know, military witnesses and some in charge of nuclear weaponry, it sort of spun it around, and they didn't know what to do. And that's why even since then I've declined a lot of stuff. And talking to other researchers like yourself, they have done the exact same thing as you. They've declined things because it's not giving the it's not being looked at from not believing it or believing it. You know, you've got to, if you know nothing about this, you've got to be neutral, looking at the evidence on both sides of the fence, and they don't seem to do that. And even if they say they do, once it gets to the cutting table, you can be sure something else is going to happen. That's why I recommend people, and I've said this a lot, that if you do media, do it live, because then you've got control of what you say and it can't be edited if it's live, because, you know, it's live. So that's my little tip for people with the media.
Yeah, I think that's very good. So that's a very good point. And, you know, and with the Today Show, we also decided that because we're Victorian UFO Action and we're based in Victoria, the Herald Sun had really accomplished for us what we'd wanted to achieve in that, you know, we'd brought it to the attention of Victorians. Me going on national television wasn't really going to accomplish much for us as a group. You know, we focus on Victoria. That's our main area of interest. We'd reached our target audience of all the Herald Sun Sunday readers, and that was a very good pool to draw from. Me talking to people in Queensland and New South Wales and other areas about UFOA didn't seem overly relevant to us, and probably would have brought attention away from local groups with people ringing us from other states with their particular stories that we can't investigate practically from Victoria. So we didn't want to steal the thunder of any other groups around the country by going onto the national arena with the Today Show.
No, well, it's good that you think like that. And what I like about you guys is that you're actually getting out and doing something. I don't like all researchers just for the simple fact that a large majority sit behind a computer and that's all they do. They don't get out. And even if they do that, a lot of them don't pick up the phone. They don't talk to the people that are having the experiences or who have seen something. They just go off a report and that sort of thing, and they base everything on that. They don't sort of, you know, get into the nitty-gritty. And the other thing is that you've got enough members of the group where you're and I've said it on the show before, is that what people need to do if they want to become experts or researchers is they need to hone in on one or two areas of the field and get knowledgeable on it and have some expertise in that area, because you can't cover everything. And that seems what your group does, is that you cover everything, but there's a lot of, like, you know, 9 or 10 of you or whatever it is that, you know, you hone in on your own expertise and you've got your own area. And once you do it as a group, you're sort of getting a full, you're doing a proper investigation.
That's correct. That's correct. And like, our guys have even gone cold calling. That's what we've done. We've been out. We knew a UFO had landed at a particular location in Sunbury, in Melbourne, and we knew that the UFO had touched down in that area. And some of my junior investigators at the time actually went and cold called the property and made contact with the people who were living there, and we were able to get access to the property and have a look at it. And that's the sort of stuff that we're prepared to do. We like to take it to the streets. We want to get out there. We want to you know, get involved. We want to get into suburbia and see what people are up to. We had our first public meeting in Melbourne in October, and it wasn't advertised, and we had 40 people come along to a non-advertised meeting, which was a really great turnout.
Yeah, that's good that you're doing that type of thing. With some of the sightings, do you ever contact the air services at all about possible types of craft or anything in the area at the time?
Yeah, look, as part of what we do, you know, you do get the odd occasion where, you know, you can send a request off to you know, to Tullamarine, and you may or may not get an answer. You know, they tend to view the topic very dimly in that arena.
Yeah. When I started having my sightings, I actually sent them emails, you know, saying was anything, and I had had a witness to multiple occasions to a group of sightings I had in October 2010, and it was funny because they said there was nothing in the area at the time, and then after that they kept on repeating the same thing, but yet I've got the video of the footage and a witness, and this object just hovers there and shoots off, and one time it's sort of slow creeping across the sky, going back and forth on itself, and wasn't a plane, wasn't a helicopter, but it was just interesting. And actually, one time they told me that the radar system was they told me that the air control tower is shut in Albury at the time when the sightings were happening, and then they told me that their radar system, the head one for the air services, was also shut down. So I'm thinking, well, so nobody's looking at radar or anything nationally. And I spoke to a bloke later on who was in the military when I was doing a talk down in Melbourne. And he said, yeah, that all the stuff in your area would be monitored from the head place, which would be in Victoria because Albury's right on the border. We're just on New South Wales side, but, you know, Albury-Wodonga. And I thought, well, that's just funny that they've sent me back saying that their control tower system was not even on at that time as well. You know, sort of jarring themselves up. Well, you know, that was off. We've got no radar happening here or control tower happening here in Albury. So I thought it was a waste of time after that, which I didn't bother. But I thought, you know, just worth giving that type of thing a go. But once you get those responses, like you said, they don't look at this as a reality, or, you know, don't even have an interest in it.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, for the most part too, you know, it's very hard to get them to answer your questions. Like, you know, it's not something that they want to spend their time looking at.
Exactly, exactly. It's just fodder to them. So,
yeah.
You just got to move on with it, yeah.
Yeah.
So, any more cases going on down that way that are other researchers in your group in their area, anything coming to light of interest?
Look, we've had quite a few really good reports come in this year. Another good one I had was some people were out camping, and they were sort of around their campfire, and they noticed this light come traveling across the treetops, and it basically came in low across the camp area where they were, completely silent, flew out around the back of them, hovered above the trees again, and then basically shot straight up into the sky just like it was disappearing, you know, in a flash. So that was quite a close encounter that we had reported to us. I had another case from the peninsula where a lady rang me up, and she told me that she was in bed one night and she had her curtains drawn closed, and she was lying in bed reading, and she had the radio on, listening to the radio, and the cat was sleeping on the bed. And all of a sudden, the radio started going all staticky. She'd lost the voices, and just static was coming from the radio. And this bright light suddenly came streaming in through her closed windows, and she had like blackout curtains, but it lit up the entire room very brightly. And the cat disappeared off the bed. It went running off, and she got out of bed and she opened up the curtains, and she could see hovering above her house this giant red object hovering not much above treetop level above the house. And she watched it for a little while, and then basically it moved out, sort of left in a southerly direction, and disappeared out sort of over the ocean area. And the next day, it had split a tree in her on the property. A tree had been split in half by this object. The cat never came back, and all the clocks had stopped in the house at the exact time when the object appeared. So it was a highly interesting case where you've got animals reacting to it. You've got physical reaction in the property and a tree being split. The clocks had stopped. Quite a fascinating little case.
Yeah, no, that's weird. Have you had any encounters or people that have had weird experiences with weird types of beings or anything, that type of thing, reported to your group?
Yes, we have. We have had that type of thing come in, and as I said, like, we usually then refer that on to Brenda to explore more fully. We have had those types of reports. Lots of people have had the experience of, beings being in the bedroom, around them at night. I had a young lady report to me that she woke up one night covered in a gel. So she woke up in a bedroom completely covered in a translucent gel after an experience that she had had. We do get that type of report as well.
Is there any old cases, contact cases or anything that sort of stick in your head that's happened in your neck of the woods in Victoria?
Well, I think the probably the most famous one we've had down here is the Kelly Cahill incident.
Yeah, yeah.
That occurred in 1993. That's probably been the biggest one that I think we've had in Victoria, certainly in terms of the fact that it had multiple witnesses to the actual event itself. And we've been to the location where she had that experience. We went out there and we filmed a documentary on the location at that particular spot where her encounter occurred. So that was a very high-profile case.
Yeah, that's been written about in a few books, I think.
It has. It has been written about in a few books. But that case is, it's fairly old now. It was 1993 when it occurred, so it was a long time ago. But since that time, every month or so, there's always someone coming forward who's had, various experiences with beings, on all sorts of levels, from, as I said before, beings in the bedroom to, being taken onto craft and implants and all that sort of stuff. So we are getting those very common themes occurring, from people who come forward and report their experiences to us. So I think that it's a phenomenon that does occur. I think it occurs certainly across the world, and I think within Australia it certainly is occurring in probably in most states of the country.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Northern Territory gets a hell of a lot. I'm good friends with Alan Ferguson, who's up that way, and he's came here and visited me as well, and there seems to be a hell of a lot of activity going on up that way, and especially along the Australian eastern seaboard. Going all the way from, Victoria all the way up to the top end.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think there's times of the year too where it's more active as well. I think
it is. I've noticed that just from my own experiences is that usually from about September, October, and about halfway through November, I get a lot more sightings than normal. And funny enough is I've spoken to people in the States who say the same thing, and it's the opposite weather over there. So it's a pretty weird thing. Now, have you ever had people contact you about showing you photos or something that you just know are full of crap, or they're actually photos from another case?
Yeah, we get that. I mean, a lot of people will send us photos and footage, and I've had people send me pictures of street lights and car headlights, and you know, Venus is a good one, yeah. Particularly in video. You get Venus crops up a lot in video, and unfortunately with video is that when a lot of people are filming at night, they've got their cameras out and they've got it on autofocus, and the old autofocus can't cope with the bright point of light and the dark background. So what it does is it actually turns that little bright light into a kaleidoscope of colors, and it looks like it's spinning. It looks like there's all sorts of magical things going on, but it's purely a camera filming a point of light in the sky, and you know, oftentimes it really is Venus that's being filmed.
Yeah, that's why they need to take it and put it on manual, as I do. And the other tip is too that I've got is try to get a tripod. It took me a while to even be able to afford one, but now I've got different types of infrared binoculars as well. There's a good one that I've got, McGinnon, I think it's called the brand, and it's a 4x50, but it's good enough where if something was close by, you'd sort of get the trees and some of that type of thing, so you've got, you know, some perspective if you went and investigated. But a lot of, if you're having a lot of sightings out there, I recommend some form of night vision. I've even got old night vision. They're sort of like a 5 megapixel. It looks like a normal point-and-shoot digital camera, but it's got video on it, and I started using them. It wasn't good because for some reason it wouldn't zoom in video mode, but I got a lot of my first sightings on that type of camera. But if you can get some form of night vision, if he's, you know, somebody's having a lot of sightings, I recommend that, because you might get it in black and white or different shades of green, but it's better than, you can get better perspective than what you can on, you know, most of your digital video cameras that, you know, that are just on auto most of the time.
Yeah, look, I think as a UFO investigator, it's very, very important to never assume that you're actually looking at a UFO when someone presents a photograph or a video. I think it's very easy to sort of you know, to get excited and to jump to the conclusion that you know, that this is UFO footage. But I think any responsible investigator needs to sort of take the footage. You need to look at it quite a few times. Then you need to look at all the natural explanations that could possibly be there for what is actually in the actual imagery. And one of the most important things when it comes to video is actually the soundtrack, because the soundtrack can actually tell you a lot more than the actual vision can.
Well, that's the problem you'll have with night vision, because the night vision one is totally white noise, or you got none. So that's the difference with some night vision. There are newer ones where you can actually get the audio, but I know what you're saying, and you can see if there's been cuts or edits that way as well.
Yeah, and the point I'm also trying to make too is that listening to people's voices when they're looking at something will really tell you a lot about what they're actually looking at as well. I had one case that came to us. That some boys had filmed a UFO down in Geelong, and they were standing there filming this UFO, and the way they were talking on the soundtrack was like they were just filming, you know, something, you know, like they were just filming something every day. And what they actually were filming was a LED covered model airplane, and you can tell by the voices and looking at the footage that that these guys are filming an LED covered model plane. Now, anyone who presents footage, they, you know, and if there's a soundtrack available, it's very, very important to get a copy of that soundtrack as well and analyze the soundtrack and the vision, because both of them can be quite telling as to what you're actually looking at. And if all the questions can't be answered and you've looked at it and you've ticked off all the boxes, then certainly you can say that you've got an unknown object that's appeared in this particular photo or this particular video.
Exactly. And, you know, talking to the witnesses helps vent too. And, you know, yes. That's a big thing because, but even with that, what I find interesting is I have people come here and they have experiences, whether it's seeing something in the house or seeing craft. And it's funny because sometimes what they will see something unknown, and I will too, but the perspective is different sometimes. And I think that might be a trickster aspect from the craft itself, how we interpret what we're seeing, which is, you know, sort of a cloudy area, but it does come up in a lot of spots. You could, you know, you just look at big mass sightings and, you know, there's lots of witnesses, but everyone sort of sees something slightly different there. A lot of them see the common thing, but then it's different from what the others see. So it's a very tricky area. Do you guys have any photographic and video analysis people within your organisation?
Look, at the moment, we don't have any official people who, you know, like that sort of do
like
that
a Bruce
for
McAbee
us.
Or something. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, well, we are connected to Bruce, and we have sent him some footage that we have had come in. It just takes a bit of a process for him to look at it and to get back to us. And we have got some footage with him at the moment that was taken in Albin Vale by one of my team members, and it was actually on the Sunrise TV show. He went on that and on 3AW in Melbourne at the time. And that footage has also been sent to McAbee. So yeah, we do. If we get something that's worthwhile, we'll send it off. But for the most part, a lot of the stuff we get, you know, it's very inconclusive. And I suppose we sort of self-regulate ourselves in that sense of the word, that if we think we've truly got something anomalous and something that's worthy of sending to really high quality experts around the world, we most certainly will do that. But not all footage we get meets that criteria.
Yeah, yep. No, it's, you know, just one of those things. Now, do you guys network with any researchers, you know, around Australia? Like just trying to, you know, talk to each other and find commonalities, or just, you know, bring up, like, is chat with any other researchers throughout Australia?
Yes, we certainly do. And I'm a great believer in doing that, because I think it's very, very important that we have a kind of a unified approach in the country towards the topic. Now, having said that, we don't all have to be a part of the same group and work in exactly the same ways, because we all like to do things our own way and in our own states doing our own thing. And I think that's very healthy to operate like that. But having the ability to come together and talk about the topic and support each other and have a bit of a brainstorming session is something that I'm very passionate about and believe in strongly. And yes, we do talk to numerous groups around the country. We talk to New South Wales UFO Research, Queensland. We've had talk to the guys in Tassie before. We talked to Keith Basterfield a fair bit in South Australia. So you know, we do have quite a bit of contact with other people. And we're all very supportive of one another, and you know, and I'd love to have those conversations occur more regularly than they probably do. But we certainly do have the channels open, and we are all there for each other.
Yeah, you don't find there's any bickering or arguing or backstabbing going on like there is a lot in the other countries in this field.
I think that it does occur, but I must say that I've spoken to the Queensland groups, the New South Wales groups, the Tassie groups, basically the Eastern Seaboard, and I've found for the most part that most of them are very good people, and we might approach it a bit differently in different groups and in different states and things like that, and I think that's healthy to do that. I don't support the model of a national model where there's the same group in every state. I tend to not go for that idea so much, because it becomes very big if you've got one big organisation across the whole country, and I think it becomes a little unwieldy, and they tend to run out of steam over time, organisations that have that model. Whereas if you've got your own state-based models, like, you know, we're so Victorian-centric and Victorian-focused, we can really focus our energies on our state. If other people are doing that in other states, then it means that the country as a whole is getting really good coverage by dedicated people in each area.
Yeah, no, it's a good way to look at it. Like I said earlier, you know, you've sort of just got to focus on some areas, and especially when you're investigating, you sort of just got to focus in one spot as well, because, you know, you just can't be flying all over the country or, you know, think you can be taking care of the whole lot. I think Australia is pretty good with the researchers too that I have spoken to, just from the fact that I think Australian people are more laid back and chilled out and more open-minded than some countries too, and we're sort of like, if that's their perspective, that's their perspective, and we sort of don't worry too much about it.
No, that's right. And I think that different groups, you know, as I touched on before, I think different groups do have different focus. Like, some groups focus more on alien abduction and alien abduction support and that type of thing, for the most, and we do that as well. But we sort of also we take a very practical approach to the topic. And I wrote it a UFO investigator's field guide for Australian conditions, and my group is now using that. So we've sort of we sort of take a very practical view of the topic, and you know, we want to get out there and you know, take it to the streets, you know, be proactive, get out and investigate the sightings. You know, if there's a landing, even better. You know, we definitely do believe in being proactive.
Now, what type of equipment do you have for trace landing cases? Do you have any Geiger counters and equipment for metal samples to put soil samples to put in glass jars, because other things can contaminate what's, you know, picked up in that top? You've got all the whole kit and caboot ready to go?
Oh, look, we don't have the complete kit. We have some equipment. Like every group, we suffer from funding issues.
Yeah, yep.
We have to raise our own money or spend our own dollars. You know, we've got things like metal detectors and Geiger counters and that type of thing, but we don't have a whole lot of equipment. Like some of the ghost hunting organisations are fairly well equipped with equipment.
Yeah, I've got everything, mate, and it took me years to get it. Yeah, I've got absolutely 3 cases chock-a-block full and probably about 20 cameras. But, yeah, I know what you're saying. It's I spent a lot of money on that thing. And even when I did get the surveillance cameras up here, I had to shut them off soon enough because the power it was draining was just so much, and I had to have a computer just for the recording of that. So, you know, I know exactly what you're saying. Now, you guys are going to do a Skywatch soon, aren't you?
Yes, we are. We're planning in probably in January to have what I call a Sky Education Night. And really what it's aimed at doing is to get out in Melbourne, and we're just discussing a couple of possible locations where we can have it, where we can get our people who are members of the website to come along, and we're going to invite you know, like an astronomer to come along, and to get everybody out there and to look up at the night sky in the summertime and have a good look at what is actually up there, you know, what actually can you see, the planets, the constellations, the satellites, and all that type of thing. And basically to give people a bit of an idea that the sky, the night sky, actually is very alive.
Oh, it's bloody active, really active.
Yeah, there is. There's lots of things going on up there. And I think for a lot of people, they're not actually educated well enough on what actually is in the sky and what is normal and what is not normal. So that's what we're doing. So it's not so much taking it from a UFO point of view, like having it, you know, like up there looking for UFOs. We're kind of taking it from the position that we want to get as many people to come along as possible, learn about the night sky. If we see a UFO, great, but that's not the entire object of the evening. I think a lot of time people will have a UFO watch night and everyone's disappointed because they didn't see anything. So what we're planning to do is we're going to say, okay, come along to the evening. We'll educate you about all the constellations, the planets that appear. We'll give you a full rundown on everything in the night sky. So when you go home, you can actually look up in the night sky and understand what a satellite is, understand what a meteorite is, understand all the different things. So I'm very passionate about it, and I think that it's a great opportunity for members of the public to come along. And also you're doing it with a group of people who are interested in UFOs, and you can talk about that topic as well while we're learning about the night sky.
Nah, it's good going to meet each other, and you're exactly right. A lot of people just don't look up, and they're not acquainted with what's going on up there. And, yeah, like we get a hell of a lot of activity here, but, you know, a lot of activity I can discount just straight up, you know. And it's funny because, you know, a lot of people will be pointing at a plane. It's like it's clear as day. It's a plane. And, you know, then you get your satellites and you get other phenomena happening in the sky, meteorites and, you know, other similar things like that, and things burning up or reflection off the sun, you know, because just after dark with types of satellites and other objects, just, you know, weird stuff like that. But they don't know, and they can read up on it, but unless they've got personal experience, that's when it sort of is glued into the mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And something else we're planning to do in the summer this month, this year, or in 2014 also, is we're going to run a UFO tour.
All right, so what does that entail?
Okay, so a UFO tour is we're fairly, well, members of my group are fairly well versed with Victorian UFO history. We're going to organise a day where members of the public can come along, hop on a tour bus, and we're going to take them to various locations around Victoria where some of our most exciting UFO encounters have actually occurred. And people can come along, they can visit the locations in real time, stand in the exact spots where these events occurred, and hear the history and you know, the events of what actually happened.
Now, that's something I haven't heard of before. It's sort of like a ghost tour, but yeah, except it's in the UFO field and you might not see something, but it's taking you to the spots where the events have taken place. That's pretty cool.
Well, that's right. And that was my idea. I thought people out there are really going to want to, people out there are interested in UFOs. And a lot of people don't know about these. You could walk down the street and say Fred Volantich, Kelly Cahill, Ron Sullivan. You could walk around saying those names out in the streets and people would look at you blankly. They'd have no idea about it. And these are Australia's well-known cases that I'm talking about, too. So let alone any other cases that aren't known. So I thought that, you know, taking people out and say that you're going to show them a UFO is a pretty big call on anyone to do that. But I thought there's enough rich history in Australia's UFO history that if we offer a UFO tour in the summer months where people can come along, hop on a coach, go for a drive, go to Westall, go to Cape Otway, go to a few other places around the place and hear about these wonderful UFO stories and events that have occurred and have a nice lunch at the same time, it sounds like a pretty damn good day out to me.
Well, I'm up for anything that brings public awareness because I spoke about this with Damien Knott too. He's actually setting up a museum up at Taree.
Yeah.
And it's got to the point now where, like, I'll do talks for UFO groups and I've got nothing against them because you're doing something, you're honing in on your fields, you're producing stuff, you're getting data, you're seeing correlations and so forth. But what's really done is trying to get public awareness where, like I said, I don't mind doing UFO talks, but 9 times out of 10, it's preaching to the choir. And I'm just going down to Melbourne actually in a few, actually probably two weeks from today to go and do a talk at, a theatre where I did it last year and a couple of people had sightings and whatnot, but these were not investigators or researchers. These were just the average Joe from about 20 up to about 35. Yeah. And it was really cool. They were actually drinking and having a few beers while it was going on. The place was packed. And I was just showing some of the footage and talking about experiences and that type of thing. And I felt really good walking out going, well, that's what needs to be done is just – it's putting it into the minds. Like, I don't want people to base their opinions on what I've got to say, and I say that at the talks. It's like, you're your own man, you make your own decisions, but here's something, and if you go and do some research, you'll see there's something to it. But it was good that, you know, you walk out, and these people hadn't seen anything like that, aren't into any group or into researching, and you know, you feel good walking out, and it's bringing public awareness, and that's what Damien Knott's trying to do up at his way and with some of the talks he conducts. And, you know, thumbs up to you guys for doing that.
Yeah, I think you know, what you've touched on is very relevant. You know, it's about public awareness, and it's also about, you know, educating the public and in a whole that they don't have to view the topic with, you know, with skepticism or with, you know, or thinking that the whole thing's silly and everybody's crazy. I mean, people who I talk to, you know, when I say that I run a UFO group and that I go to UFO meetings, people will say to me, God, do you meet any crazy people there? And I say, look, I've been to many UFO meetings and I don't think I've met a crazy person yet. So, you know, there's a big misnomer out there among the public that if you're into UFOs or that if you've had a UFO experience that you must be crazy or you're loopy and you're not all there. And that's completely opposite because, you know, everybody that I interact with, certainly on a, you know, professionally within the field and the people that we talk to have had the encounters, you know, everybody that I talk to has been a rational, normal human being who's had an incredible experience.
Yeah. No, I noticed that too. It's usually the people that are nameless and faceless are sort of the sometimes a bit wacky in it, and usually they're just somebody sitting behind a computer and yeah, it's just one of those things. But I found that with the talks I have done and the UFO groups I have spoken to, they're, you know, some of them have got pretty good positions in society, they're well versed in the subject, and you know, they're good upstanding people. And I do intention experiments here where we do meditation, and I've got a lot of footage up of crafts powering up, interacting with the laser. I said on the last show I took my mum and her friend out mum had never seen a UFO. And as I say, it doesn't happen every time. It's really about the conscious aspect of what's going on. And but it, you know, funny enough, there was four of us there, and mum wanted to go home because she thought they were going to land. They were coming down pretty darn low. They were, you know, just above tree height. And yeah. But with that, you get some wackies, and that's why I don't actually take it. You know, some people take everyone out and they charge them hundreds. I don't charge any money, and on top of that is I don't let anybody do it with me, and that's what I'm actually going to put a thing up soon where people can do it themselves, because I don't know where they're at, and you've really got to be know yourself and know where you're at, because I don't know if you've realised this. I've had a lot of experiences on the program already, and what I find with talking to them and myself is intent is a very big thing in this field, especially with experiences. Like now, there are times, like you're bringing up how there's that case with the two girls you're talking about. They're not into the field at all. They don't research it, and, you know, they have an experience. Then yeah. There's the other side of it where people are their intent is just focused on this subject, and they seem to attract experiences to them, or weird stuff, or just synchronicity events, or something happening. And you might even have found that with your own research. You'll be researching something, and then all of a sudden, another aspect of that case will come to you without you even looking at it, looking for it. So yes, it's pretty weird how this all plays out, and you know, it's just one of those fascinating things that I thought I'd bring up is just the intent. Have you noticed that yourself with your research? Like you'll be stuck into, you know, researching a case, and then other things will come to the play?
Yeah, I've definitely seen that occur before, you know, where, yeah, you're looking at something and, then something else comes to light, or you think you've come to a dead end on something and you know, something just pops up out of the blue. So, yeah, it definitely does occur.
Now, have you got any other upcoming events or anything going on with the website besides what you've already mentioned?
Look, I think that's pretty much what we've got planned for the rest of the year. Like, we're off to Burke's Flat next weekend. That'll be a full weekend in November. We're also going to have our, I suppose the other event we're going to have before the year's out is our VUFOA Christmas party, which we hope to hold in December, where members can come along and just have a nice social evening with other people in the field, and to have a casual Christmas get together, a Christmas meal and a Christmas drink perhaps. I think that'd be nice to round out what has been a fairly busy year for us. Next year we'll kick off with the Sky Education Night. The UFO tour will follow probably a month after that. And and then next year, like, our cold case work will continue. I love cold cases. I love researching. I love bringing up people that are hard to find and delving into the cold cases. The hotline will keep us busy with new cases coming through. So, yeah, I think, you know, and we're always looking for new members as well. So if anyone's in Victoria and they're interested in becoming involved, then I encourage them to contact us. But I would just like to say that it does require a fair amount of commitment to be a UFO researcher. And, you know, so if you only have a casual interest in it, then it might not be for you, because we are just so passionate about what we do. If you want to get involved and become a team member, you need to have a deep commitment to the topic.
Fantastic. Well, I've put a link up to your website on my website where this will be downloaded and available for people. And they'll be able to get to your site from there and be able to check yours out and go through some of the pages and check out the vids and some of the documents and stuff you got up there. And anybody in Victoria yep. has a sighting, think of these guys and just go to that link, or just remember them and go there. So I'd like to thank you heaps for coming on the show, Ben, and we've got to do it again sometime.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. It was a real pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Yep, no worries, mate. All right, well, you have a good one and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.